finally saw some rain after a stretch of severe drought. But will it be enough to quench our parched trees and lawns? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we'll talk with our experts about drought stress remediation and what this dry weather could mean for fall foliage. We'll also hear about an early warning system to detect when non-native plants could threaten agriculture or wild spaces. Joining me now for our full hour of gardening are University of Cincinnati Professor of Biological Sciences, Teresa Cully. Thanks for being here, Teresa.
Thank you, Lucy.
Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you.
And Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO, John Butcher. Welcome back to you too, John.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi. UC and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping are financial supporters of Cincinnati Public Radio. Our experts are here to answer your questions. We know you have them, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. John, until yesterday, when we got a gully washer, it had been so dry for so many weeks in Southwest Ohio. What has that drought stress meant for trees?
Well, there's going to be a lot of trees that were on the already stressed side of things that might not make it through this drought period, and they might not be dead now. But I think next spring, we really need to take a close look and see what's made it through the winter or not, because that was a really bad drought period. But most trees that were healthy going into that period should come out okay next spring.
So if they were kind of on the edge, those are the ones that are, those are the ones that could be in trouble.
Correct.
Yeah. Will the drought mean we won't be able to enjoy our beautiful fall foliage the same way, John?
I think it'll be a little different when you lose as many leaves that are already on the ground that never had a chance to turn. I think fall color will be less this year.
Okay, well, I have a very pointed question from our technical director, Marshall Verbsky. This is very important. He controls our microphones and can make us sound bad. So just a heads up. Marshall is getting married in late October. Will the leaves be less colorful due to the drought, or will all of them have fallen off the trees early? He signed it a concerned citizen, but we know it's Marshall.
I think in his particular magical area, all of the leaves are going to be perfect and fall color will be terrific there.
Well, that's great. What do you think, Teresa? Do you have advice for Marshall as he prepares? I think it's in the Loveland area. Am I right, Marshall, in case that? And there is love in Loveland, so.
That is true. Yeah. Loveland is the city of love.
Yeah.
I think probably my estimate would be there's going to be fewer leaves than before, but hopefully enough to make it a wonderful, memorable occasion.
Okay. Lots of good pictures. That's what it's all about. Peter, what has this drought meant for vegetable gardens?
Well, as with trees, it puts the vegetable plants under a lot of stress. And so one of the things you need to do is to maintain regular irrigation or watering. But also, what we do very heavily is that once the drought started kicking in, we also mulched with straw. And then we do use drip line irrigation in most of our beds. And so we would run that. But also, periodically, we would overhead water to kind of keep the straw matted down and also to kind of cool it off to keep the plants cool. But you do see, I mean, we actually had some problems with blossom and rot later in the season with the tomatoes because that often will come as a result of irregular watering.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. But the biggest thing that, well, we're kind of coming out of it now, but if we don't go back into it, but it really, even now I would recommend mulching with straw or another material.
How much work is that to make sure that mulch has the moisture that it needs and all the irrigation and all that? How much work is that for? I mean, you're a pro, you're mm-hmm. with Turner Farm, but for the average home gardener, is that a lot of work?
It's really not. I mean, it depends how big your garden is, your vegetable garden is, obviously. But most home gardens are less than 1,000 square feet, and many are just people have maybe 2 or 3 4 by 8 foot beds. And really, if you had 4 8-foot beds, one bale of straw is more than enough. You know, one thing you may want to consider when you purchase straw, if you buy your straw from a nursery or landscaping operation as opposed to a farmer, it's going to be more expensive, but it's going to be cleaner. It'll have less seed in it because it's baled and harvested in a way with that idea that it's being used to mulch over new seeded areas or people's plants and stuff. So it's worth paying that extra $3 or $4 a bale mm-hmm. And to use that. But you just need to put like around 2 inches down And then, like I said, water before you put it down, put the straw down, then surface water that, and it kind of felts it or compresses it down so it won't blow away.
Okay, great. We do have a caller on the line. Hey, thanks for listening. What is your question or comment?
Hi, I have a 30-year-old crabapple tree, and earlier this summer it had some green leaves. It had some dead branches, and I cut them off. Now there's not a green leaf on it. It looks completely dead. Should I cut it down, or should I wait till the springtime to see if it revives itself?
What do you think, John?
Well, there's a couple of options. The first thing I would do is do what we call a scratch test. And if you go out to the new growth on the tips of the plant and just take your thumbnail and scratch it lightly, either it'll be really light green and vibrant underneath, or it'll be brown and really hard to scratch. And if it's green, you're good to go, and you don't really have to worry about it. If it's brown, I'd still wait until spring and give it a chance to come back. But there's a fungal disease called apple scab that causes early leaf drop that's really common on anything in the crabapple family, Rosaceae family.
Hmm. What can you do about that?
I think the best thing to do is really to just tolerate it to some degree or pick resistant species. There are fungicide treatments that help keep that on, and it's a repetitive thing every year, and you just have to decide if that's the decision you want to make or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You can use a sulfur spray. And University of Kentucky, NKU, has an excellent bulletin on fruit for the homeowner. Mm. And it gives like the time of year to spray and what you can spray, but it gives organic options, which is what I really highly recommend. But, the crab apples as well as other apples are, like you said, really susceptible to that. And if you want a healthy fruit for harvesting, it's really hard not to do a dormant or light summer, what's called an oil spray, but then also to treat the trees once with sulfur.
And did you say that's a University of Kentucky Extension Office bulletin or Northern Kentucky University?
I'm sorry, Northern Kentucky.
Northern Kentucky University. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and if someone wants to email you and ask you, I can forward you the PDF of the document for them.
Okay. Super. I hope that helps. Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Did you want to add anything to that, Teresa? I didn't mean to...
Oh, no. What I was going to say, actually, is that oftentimes when someone has a dead tree in their yard or a sick tree and they're not sure if it's dead, one of the things that I always recommend is the scratch test that John mentioned was a great idea. I also visually look to see if there's any damage to the trunk or the stems and to see specifically for boring holes, so insects that might bore into a hole, bore into there, lay an egg. I've lost a red bud that way. So that's another way just to keep an eye on it. And especially with the drought, when trees are stressed, they tend to be more susceptible to all these other pathogens and bugs that might attack.
Well, just like people, when you're stressed, you can get sick. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's our full hour of gardening today, and our experts are ready to answer your questions. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Teresa, what has the drought meant for our perennials? How should we have been caring for them, or how should we care for them going forward if this rain is just teasing us and we go into drought conditions again?
Yeah, I think a lot of people who have perennials in their yard just assume that they're fine and they're really hardy and they might not need water. But just like trees, just like annuals, certainly they do need water. And so hopefully people have been watering those plants at least once a week is what I try to do. If not, they might be starting to senesce, in other words, die back a little earlier in the season. And so you might just want to trim those back a little bit and then perhaps mulch, as was already suggested. Mm-hmm. But then also just keep an eye on them and see what happens in the spring, and hopefully they'll come back.
John, how should we be caring for our trees during the drought conditions that we've had, or the conditions like that?
Trees really want a deep, thorough soaking. So on a perennial, you might be able to just get away with a bucket full of water. But on an established shade tree or an evergreen, you want to really soak the entire root system. And I usually say focus on within the drip line of the tree, just because that's where your highest concentration of roots are at. So you get the most bang for the buck. But an overhead sprinkler for 5, 6, 7 hours and really soak the soil deeply, and then come back in a week and do the same thing.
Hmm. What about fruit production on fruit trees, Peter? Has the drought had a big impact on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime a tree goes into stress, it'll jettison fruit. I mean, most of fruit had already been harvested, you know, like the pears and the peaches and everything. So it kind of, they were finishing up when the drought started. I know we have persimmon at home and one of the gardens, and, you know, they don't come ripen until November and December. So we just kind of watch that, but they're still, the fruit looks pretty good. But like you're saying, is that they're trying to give them a good soaking. I know Chris Smith with the Common Orchard program had been sending out reminders to everybody. They recommended, because a lot of those trees are younger, to give them 5 gallons of water a week. And like you said, you know, put it around the drip line, because we're talking about smaller trees, not like a giant oak. Mm-hmm. So that's very important.
Yeah. Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
I'm having a basement problem. My foundation is sinking, probably due to water. I was wondering if anybody knew where I could get a core sample drilled to determine what kind of soil is deep down there by my basement foundation.
Hmm. Interesting. What do you think, John? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I mean, I think you want a soil or structural engineer involved in this issue, and it's beyond my level of expertise for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's definitely true.
Yeah, I think if you called the city's building department, there's probably someone they can recommend. Because I know down in the East End, before they do any building, they do go down there and take core samples. So, I mean, there's definitely a service you can pay someone to do for you. But you definitely want, you know, you want someone who knows what they're doing to do it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I hope that helps, Kurt. Okay, well, we are going to keep talking about gardening. We've got a full hour today. Please call our experts with your questions. The number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We have an email from the last gardening show that we didn't get to, because sometimes that happens. Lisa wrote, when is the best time to aerate and overseed the lawn? I know lawns have been real thirsty during this drought, too. John, do you have any tips for that?
Well, I mean, the best time to grow seed is in September, and that can vary a little bit depending on the season. But I think despite how hard the ground is, you might want to try to do it then and make sure you water for the best results. But if you can't water anything, you may not want to put seed down, and you might want to do a later end of September, early October aeration and overseed just so you can get some water to the new seed.
Okay. Similarly, we got an email from Rob who writes, when's the best time to overseed a lawn? I recently put on the, I'm going to say this wrong, Fertilome's Lawn Food Plus Iron. Do you have thoughts on that, Teresa, or...
I don't know. I'm looking to John and Peter on that one. I mean, you definitely don't want to do it in a drought. I mean, that's for sure. So wait until some water comes out, unless you're waiting for natural water, or you yourself are watering. I think that's the key.
I have to say that I'm inherently biased to the trees, which are in conflict with the lawn. But I would, most fertilization, you need to have adequate moisture in the soil for that to really be the best thing to do. Yeah.
Okay, John, you just rocked my world there. The trees are in conflict with the lawn. Is this a conflict that's happening in our yards all over the place?
Every day, yes.
Tell me more about that, John. What's the conflict? Don't they get along?
Well, there's competition for resources, and when resources become scarce, they're fighting to get water or nutrients, whatever that, you know, limited resources.
But when you're watering, like, your tree to give it a big old gulp, doesn't that help your lawn, too?
It does, yeah. That's the unfortunate consequence of watering your tree, is the lawn gets its benefit, too.
Wow, we're getting some real lawn hate now. We're stirring things up. Peter, what do you think of lawns? Are you anti-lawn?
I'm not anti-lawns, but trying to limit the size and the number of them.
Yeah.
I mean, we actually we're experimenting this year at the Price Hill Garden with using grass in between some of the garden beds. I don't really like spreading wood chips and mulch all over the place in the pathways. I prefer having grass. Mm-hmm. I think that it actually, if you don't, we leave it, let it grow, we cut it at 3 inches, and just short enough so that it doesn't go to seed. And then I just think it actually keeps the site cooler. It retains water. It controls erosion. Mm-hmm. So I'm not against lawns. But at home, we have a large meadow with native flowers and plants in it. And and I prefer trees and wooded lots as opposed to having an acre of grass to mow.
Oh, what do you think, Teresa? Are you going to stir things up some more?
I am. So I'm going back off of John's point about the trees. And what a lot of people don't know is that some plants, including some trees, are what we call allelopathic. So they produce chemicals that actually prevent other plants from having their seeds that germinate around them. So a great example is black walnut. So if you look at a black walnut tree, oftentimes there's not other things growing around it, including lawn, or it might be really scraggly. And that's because the plant itself has some chemical compounds in its leaves and its fruits that drop and then get incorporated to the soil. And then it prevents other plants from germinating around it. So
it's looking out for number one.
Yeah. So I always tell people that plants actually are pretty darn smart. And they're a little chemical factory sometimes.
No kidding. Wow. Okay. Well, we have some more callers on the line. Hi, Connie. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. My question was, I have a peach tree, and the peach tree, when it the leaves, they curl up. The leaves curl up on the tree, and when it produces the fruit only get about as big as, maybe a little bigger than a walnut, and the fruit is split open with the sap coming out of it. And I was just wondering what I could do to have some edible peaches on that tree.
Yeah, those don't sound good.
Peter. Yeah, I mean, that's leaf curl. And it's a fungal disease, and it's very common with peaches. And, you know, earlier when we were talking about using sulfur and then also your dormant oil sprays, that's something you can do. Another thing that people don't think about with fruit trees is that it's good to thin the fruit when they start to get the size of a marble, particularly with apples where you have clusters of five, even sometimes, is to remove some of those. And that will encourage the other fruit to get larger. That's the same thing with grapevines. You take off some of your clusters of grape. But again, the Northern Kentucky University Bulletin, I really strongly recommend that. And then also, if you're in the Cincinnati area, the Common Orchard Project that Chris Smith coordinates, they do a lot of training for people at home or growing fruit at home. And the training is just fantastic.
Mm. Well, Connie, I hope that helps, and I hope you get some good peaches.
Yeah. Okay, and it's called the Common Orchard?
The Common Orchard Project.
Yep, the Common Orchard Project.
Thank you so much.
Sure thing. Thank
Common
you, Connie.
Orchard Project.
Mm-hmm. Okay, bye-bye. We have Rich on the line. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Lucy. For your panelists, there's data out there that shows that songbird populations are down as much as 90%. Nationally, and so I was wondering if they could suggest any particular group of native trees to look at rather than ornamental to help out on some of the habitat loss that's resulted in this drop in songbird populations.
Thanks, Rich. Okay, John, are you against birds too?
No, I love birds.
Okay.
Yeah, birds are great.
Okay. Teresa, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that they could do is check out the National Wildlife Federation. So they have a wonderful website that suggests different trees. For wildlife, one of the ones I would suggest, any oak trees are excellent for wildlife. In terms of shrubs, that might be more achievable for people. One that I really, really love is a native bush called spice bush. And so that's in our area, and the berries are actually much preferred by birds. The other thing that I thought about is, we're talking about trees earlier, as the trees are dropping their leaves, it's actually really important to put the leaves back onto the surface of the soil if you can, because those will naturally decompose and continue the natural cycle. So I would encourage people not to rake up the leaves and throw them out. If they can, just toss them back over into the tree area if possible.
This is great news for everybody who hates to rake, right?
Yes.
Yeah. See, we're making so many people happy with this show right now. Rich, does that help?
It does. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Oh, Peter, did you want to add to that?
Well, kind of a shrub plant, too, is the native hazelnut. Those are nice, and they produce a smaller hazelnut. It's a lot of work to get any flesh out of, so it's not so much for culinary uses. But if you also like squirrels, the squirrels like the nuts. Yeah. But we have a colony of sparrows, which maybe some people may not like. Some people consider them like feathered mice. But I really love sparrows, and we have a nice colony of them that live in our hazelnuts.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And that's a native. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a native variety.
Well, terrific. Well, thanks for that question, Rich. We're going to have to take a quick break. We will continue our gardening show in just a few moments. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our full hour of gardening and a panel of experts to answer your questions. My guests are University of Cincinnati Professor of Biological Sciences, Teresa Cully, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO, John Butcher. We know you have questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. We have Tom on the line. Hey, Tom, thanks for your patience. What is your question?
Yes, hi. I bought some wildflower seed this spring, and I didn't get it planted. I would like to turn a little bit of my backyard into a meadow. I was wondering if you thought I could plant the seed now and have it come up in the spring. Thank you.
Yeah. I think planting, like we were talking about earlier about grass seed, but also with these wildflower mixes, fall is really your best time. You want to prepare the soil. You don't want to be throwing them into the grass. So you need to kind of scrape off the soil, loosen the soil some, make the application of your seeds, and then add maybe about a half inch of compost. Or you could use some, an inch of straw, like you'll see when people seed a grass. I personally think this is the best time. And actually, the fall is really the best time to plant trees also. Fruit, you know, I mostly deal with fruit trees, or if you have different sort of fruit-bearing shrubs like currants, gooseberry and things like that, blueberries, this is also a really ideal time to plant them as we go into winter and let them be dormant when they're exposed to a lot of moisture. And then when the spring rains come, you know that they're getting hydrated and we'll have the support system to bloom.
Mm-hmm. Do you need to make sure they're watered now, though, if you get them planted like that?
Yeah, I'll pop in and say, yeah, you definitely should get them, make sure they're watered. And I would also say, sort of echoing what Peter just mentioned, is if you plant now those wildflower seeds, you're almost in a way mimicking what would naturally happen, because many of those species would be blooming in spring and summer, and then the seeds would be falling out now. Oh. So it actually could be a good thing. Now, you might have some of the seed germination might be lower than earlier, you know, if you planted them right away. But I think it's still a really good idea to do.
Okay.
Can I add something?
Sure thing.
If we're planting new trees now or shrubs or anything like that, the once a week probably isn't going to cut it when it's this dry and you're...
Once a week, with watering, you mean?
Yeah. We're going to need to do, you know, every other day or every third day at the most, depending on how well you soak it. But you got to ramp up the watering if we're going to do it now.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. Good point.
Well, Tom, thanks so much. I hope that helps. Good luck with your meadow. And we have Sharon on the line. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, thank you. My question is, I've been during this drought, I've been using tree bags on my smaller trees, and I was just wondering what your opinion was about using them. They seem to have helped. The trees have their leaves, but there was a comment about watering around the tree line, and those basically just go down around the trunk. They drip down around the center.
Okay. Do you want to start? Teresa, you were nodding.
John and I are looking at each other. I could start. I'll say that I use tree bags, especially on my newer trees, because the point is, and someone told me once, you can never overwater a new tree. It's really important to, and I'll look to John to confirm that. He's giving me a look. But yeah, it is really important, I think, to water in any way. A tree bag does help, but I think it does not take away from the fact that you do need to water extensively, maybe more around the base. And more along the drip zone. And hopefully people know what the drip zone is, where the trees, if it was watered with rain, it would drip down.
I'm going over to John now.
Well, I like the tree bags too, but you got to fill up the tree bags with a hose. So while you're there, go ahead and soak the whole area and then fill up the tree bag, and then you get the slower drip that might help the water last a little bit longer.
Okay. Kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, Sharon. I hope that helps. We appreciate your listening. Appreciate your call. We have James on the line. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. How are you doing? What's your question for our experts?
I'm doing well. I have a question about that ash tree that I have in my yard. I have like 25 other ash trees in my yard that I had to remove due to the ash borer. And I actually removed a tree as close as 10 feet to the healthy one that I have in my yard. It's never been treated. The only thing that's different about that tree than all the others that I removed is that it's the tree I feed the birds out of. So I just wondered if they had any input, if maybe the birds could have possibly kept the boar out of that tree, or if maybe the sunflower seed dropping did something to the soil that made the boar not like that specific ash tree.
Hmm. What do you think, John?
Well, there are always anomalies in nature, and I think that the odds of the birds doing a good enough job, you know, they're not extracting the borer out of the tree without doing a lot of damage, and that would be woodpeckers that could really do that. So I think that you probably do have some level of borer in there. It's still an active problem. I would really recommend getting this tree treated for the ash borer if you care about it.
Would that hurt the birds?
You know, I haven't seen any research that suggests that, but I don't have all world power to say there's no potential negative impact. But
okay, we'll ask our PhD at the table.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, I could say that right now, from what we know, is that it doesn't hurt any of the birds. So the chemical that is used to treat emerald ash borer is taken up into the vascular system of the plant, and as far as I know, it's no negative impacts.
Well, and the ash don't have fruit that the birds are eating, which is a positive on that front.
Yep, yep, you're right.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps, James. I'm glad you've still got that one ash tree. Thanks so much for listening and for calling. And we have Sandy on the line. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Hey, I want to thank you so much for having this program. It's so educational. I just love it.
Well, thanks.
My question is, I have an older lawn. I had to take out a redbud tree in the backyard, and I did fertilize the grass, but not anything much was growing where the redbud tree was, so I purchased some grass to plant, and that came up. But now that it's so dry, and I've been trying to water in those areas, I noticed that soil in that area is really clay-based. What would be advisable to put down or do before I want to plant or seed anything there to, get that soil more enriched?
Okay.
Can I ask a question? When you took the red bud out, did you have the stump ground out? Did you dig it out? What was the process of the removal?
Yeah, they couldn't get the stump machine in my backyard because of fences, so they chopped out and down a good maybe 4 feet or so of the stump out. So there's probably still a root system in the ground there.
Well, so having the organic matter in there decomposing is probably going to hurt the new grass from coming up in the beginning until it breaks down all the way. So if there's any way to get the stump out or stump chips, if someone was to grind it, is really helpful. And then you can add even just fresh topsoil that you'd buy from a garden center would be a perfectly fine thing to put down.
Mm-hmm. Any other tips from Teresa or Peter?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, if you put down some garden soil, it sounds like it's not that big of an area. Put down a couple bags, then use like a hoe, a stirrup hoe or something, and kind of work it into existing soil, and then seed on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. I'm optimistic for some reason that, you know, we're going to have more normal rainfall from here on in, just seasonally. You know, I hope I'm right.
Yeah.
So I do think that, you know, you should look to, you know, in the next several weeks, if it, you know, unless we move into another drought period, go ahead and do your reseeding of your lawns, and aerating, I think, is a good idea.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening, Sandy.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Hope that helps. And we have an email. Laura emails, I wanted to see if someone could elaborate regarding the lawn competition, lawn hate topic. There are ways to still have green patches and also have it be good for pollinators by planting clover varieties. Can they elaborate on how people can do that and not have just a lawn that's a desert for critters? Also, encouraging people to refrain from weed chemicals, Roundup, mosquito sprays so the beneficial insects, butterflies, bees can survive. You're nodding, Teresa. Are those all things that
Yeah, those are things that I've also thought about, having moved into a home which had a huge, extensive lawn. And then over the years, we've chipped away at the lawn and we've expanded out the flower beds, making sure to plant a variety of native. And I also have some non-native species in there as well that are friendly for wildlife. And so for me personally, that's just a process where I'm slowly pushing out the grass in a way. The caller had brought up clover, and so some people like to plant clover. Admittedly, that's something that some people really like clover, and they're in that camp, and some people don't. So if you do live in a homeowners association, then you need to check the codes and covenants, because that could be an issue. But there are today a lot of different alternatives to grasses, clover being one of them, that are more friendly for wildlife, and namely bees. And in particular, I'm thinking about native bees.
Mm-hmm. And John, I want to let you weigh in, because during the break, John did clarify it's not so much that he's a grass hater, it's the grass treatment, right? That so many people, these chemicals.
Yeah, it's just such a large amount of chemicals that we put down to have perfect lawns. And I am in favor of lawns that have what a lot of people would consider weeds, but that is clover and violets and dandelions. And, you know, a lot of people are probably cringing and don't want to hear that, but I think it's much better for all of us if we have lawns that have a lot of diversity in them.
Yeah, I hope all my old neighbors are listening, because, man, that's what our lawn looked like all the time, and I feel so much better about it now.
And the violets seem to move in on their own. We do at the community gardens and at home, we do do broadcast some white Dutch clover. You don't want to do it too heavy. And you can't – some people have talked about using white Dutch clover instead of grass. It has to be intermingled with something else. But the thing to remember about white Dutch clover is it is pollinating insects like it, which is a good thing. So if you have an area where your children are playing, or you want to sit around a lot, maybe keep that more like an outdoor room, living room, and don't put your mixed seed in there and around the peripheral, put out the clover, which I think is pretty, and I love the violet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned violets, so I have to come back to that one. So I did a lot of work on violets years ago, and one of the really cool things that people might not realize is the blue violet, and this works for it in your yard, the way it gets around, and Peter, I mentioned it sort of moves around, is it has seeds that are ballistically dispersed. And a lot of people don't know this.
Ballistically
dispersed.
That sounds violent.
It's well, in the plant world, that's what we call it.
Okay.
So if anyone's familiar with touch-me-nots, and so little kids sometimes will get the little fruits and put it in their mouths, and they spring open. I don't know if that's a good idea or not nowadays. And that's what they're doing. It's a mechanical way that the plant constructs its seed, where it suddenly unwinds with force and it explodes, essentially. And so violets can do this too, and they actually have two types of flowers. So they have the normal showy violet flower, and they have a second type of flower, which is just a little bud, and it becomes a capsule, and it never has petals. And so we've measured those capsules. What they do is they dry, and they split into three valves, and then they slowly open. And each valve squeezes like if you squeezed a marble, and you could shoot it out. And so they slowly, over a period of a few minutes, will shoot out those seeds. And they can go about a meter or two away. And people just don't realize it. So that's how they get around your yard.
So they've got the pretty flower and the ammo flower.
Well, the pretty flower also does it.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you have any time-lapse video of this?
No kidding.
Really cool.
People do in Japan.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we're going to be back with our gardening show after another short break. If you have questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of today's gardening show. My guests are University of Cincinnati Professor of Biological Sciences, Teresa Cully, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO, John Butcher. Now's the time to ask your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Okay, we have Jim on the line. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I planted kale, and it was completely destroyed by what I believe is cabbage whites, the little white moths, and they're caterpillars.
Yeah.
And now it looks like little black bugs that look like little black dots have moved on to them. I don't like to use chemicals. Is there any way that I can prevent this without the use of chemicals?
Whether it's biologicals, neem oil, which you can buy at now, it's readily available at most big box stores, or there's a number of small neighborhood nurseries where you can get it. And I usually recommend getting a small container of it and then mixing it yourself in your own sprayer, small sprayer. It has a very long shelf life. And you use basically, there's instructions, it's usually around two tablespoons to a quart of water and then a little bit of dish soap to keep it suspended in the water. Mm. But that should really help. Now, the little black bugs, it sounds like, it seems kind of late in the season for flea beetles. So I can't help you on that. But for the cabbage looper, but also right now, we've been battling harlequin bugs, which is a small beetle with its orange and black. Mm. And that with them, it seems like the neem oil just irritates them more than kills them. Mm. But it causes them to come to the top of the plant, and then you can just remove them by hand and squish them or put them into a little bucket of soapy water, and it'll kill them. Definitely do that, because you should still have time for the plant to regenerate new leaves and get a crop for yourself.
Hope that helps, Jim. Thank you so much. We also have Laura on the line. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
I have a very old apple tree, and right now, I'd say on maybe four of the branches, there's blossoms all over it. And I'm just wondering, is this going to mess up the blossoms in the spring? And should I pull them off? I'm just not sure why it's happening and what I can do to help this tree.
John looks poised to answer your question.
Well, I think it's a response to stress.
Yeah. The drought.
Yeah, and those buds were set this summer to bloom next spring. So certainly there will be less blooms next spring. And cutting them off now probably isn't going to do any good. If you see fruit start to develop, you may pluck those off because you don't want any energy going into that. But I don't think there's a whole lot you can do other than wait and see.
Yeah. Also, we had that cool weather. It kind of tricks the trees, it fools the tree. And a number of our fruit apple trees at home and in the gardens, I'm seeing a small number of them. But like John said, just let nature take its course, and you will get fewer buds. Those buds won't return in the spring, but you'll still have plenty more. You shouldn't worry about not having any fruit. You may have a little bit less, which you should than your fruit anyway. So in a way, nature sometimes does you a little favor.
Well, thanks, Laura. I hope that helps. And we have Don on the line. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hey, what is your question?
I have a very, very large lawn, and I was told that I have a weed called hairy bittercress that's taken over more than 50% of the yard. And I don't like to use chemicals. I went to a garden center, and they suggested that I do use a chemical. I'd like to get this weed eliminated or under control, or somehow it spreads very fast and covers large areas.
Is the weed present in your lawn now? Can you see it this time of year?
Yes.
Because the bittercress I'm familiar with is it goes away when it warms up in the spring. So maybe it's a different kind of bittercress I'm not aware of.
Yeah, this is hairy.
I don't know the scientific name of this one. Sure. But there's a weed that pops up in the spring called bittercress. It's everywhere, and it basically goes away before summer gets in too hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a tough one. There are some species that are considered to be invasive, if you will. I think probably what the caller has been told is probably to get rid of the lawn itself with Roundup. At least that was what we were told at one point. And that is chemicals. So, and you might, you know, that's a decision. And it sounds like you don't want to go that route, which is perfectly fine. I would try to get a better ID of that plant.
I would have a lawn care professional that does treatments come out. There's lots of good local ones in the area. They can assess what the weed is and what the appropriate management strategy is for that. And without seeing the weed or knowing exactly what it is, but there's probably a selective herbicide that you can use if you want to go that route and not destroy the whole lawn, if I had to guess.
Yeah. Well, I hope that helps, Don. Good luck with that hairy bittercress. I do want to talk with you, Teresa, about this research you've been doing into early warning signs about non-native plants. You have this network, I think it's 54 public gardens. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, how it works.
Yeah, certainly. So one of the hats that I wear is for the state of Ohio. I have a team of people that I work with, and we list plants as invasive for the entire state. We have a whole process of doing that. We go through the literature, we talk to land managers and so forth. And so one of the things we found out, and many other states have done this, is it takes what we really need to know are what plants are actually just now rising up to be a problem. Because a lot of the other ones, like amber honeysuckle and stuff like that, they're already a huge problem. They take a lot of time and effort to try to remove and take care of. And so what I discovered was I was giving talks about calorie repair, about that being a potential problem. And I went to a bunch of different public gardens. And as I would go to the gardens, I would ask them after I gave my talk, like, you know, what problems do you see in your gardens that you don't talk about so much? And the first garden said amber cork tree, but don't tell anyone. And so I went to the second garden. They said amber cork tree, but don't tell anyone. And on the third garden, I'm like, okay, are the gardens talking to each other? And it turned out they weren't. So a lot of gardens across North America are concerned about being blamed for invasive plant issues, plants that they might have started growing in their gardens from another country many years ago. And so we've just started this program, and it's just blown up in popularity, where we just get gardens contributing data that they've been collecting at their site as to which plants have been escaping cultivation and which ones are becoming a problem so much so that they might remove them from the collection. And so that's essentially what we're doing.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. We have more callers that we're going to get to, but is there a website that people can get more information about that, or if they want to maybe see if their garden can be a part of that system?
Yeah, so the project is called Public Gardens as Sentinels of Invasive Plants, which we just say PGSIP, which is admittedly a horrible acronym. But if you just go in and type in PGSIP space Morton Arboretum, that will pull up the page.
Okay. Terrific. Well, thank you so much. We have Jody on the line. Hi, Jody. What's your question?
I have one of those natural diversified lawns like John was praising before that the neighbors love.
Yes.
I also have a big mud spot in the back. Is there a way that I can plug that in for the winter right now with a natural diversified lawn?
I think you can just plant grass seed, regular, you know, turf type tall fescue or some kind of blend, and then your natural diversified lawn will fill into that area over time.
But you know, if it's muddy, you may be a low area where you may need to do some infill or aerate it, because there could be another kind of issue, like after a heavy rain. I mean, is there standing water in that area?
Yeah,
because that's something you may need to remediate.
I was going to add, too, in terms of the standing water, what I've had to do before in the past is put in a French drain, because it turned out it was a previous stream that had just
had dirt dumped over.
Jody, is this wet or is it just bare dirt?
Stream. That's exactly what it was.
Oh, it was dirt covered over a stream.
Yes. That's why it's been so difficult to get anything to grow back there. I can get it to grow and then it dies at the end of the year.
Mm. Yeah. So the other thing you might want to think about is if you can't do like any piping on there, you might want to think about plants that are more good for that type of area. So maybe willows, different
bald cypress.
Bald cypress, there you go. But if you look up rain gardens online, it might give you a bunch of different suggestions. And I can tell you the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden has a rain garden, and they do a lot of work there, too, that might have ideas for you.
Okay. Hope that helps, Jody. We're going to zip to the next caller. Hi, Curtis. Thanks for your patience. What's your question?
My question is, I'm thinking about getting a rain collector attached to my downspout in my garage, and my garage has asphalt shingles on it, and I was wondering if that rainwater would be safe to use in my vegetable garden.
Oh, because of chipping paint and things like that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So I'll take that. So I actually have a rain barrel as well with asphalt shingles, and so we actually do use that water. In my case, I use it just for my perennial flower garden. I don't see a problem. Well, I'm looking at the others too. I don't see a problem with using it for vegetables. I will say, though, that you do need to be careful because the asphalt does come out sometimes and go into the rain barrel. So you might need to double check and look in your rain barrel from time to time.
I think the only thing we've seen kind of problems with that is older asphalt roofs where there's a lot of where the shingles are degrading, or else they've used a lot of tar to patch a roof, and I've actually seen the water in the tanks be brown. I mean, obviously you don't want to use that. When you put in a brand new roof, some of that kind of gravel will go in and settle at the bottom of the rain barrel, so that kind of solves that problem. Mm-hmm. But we use them on the vegetable gardens also.
Okay. Hope that helps, Curtis. I wonder if we can get this last email in. Sally emails, between the moths and the drought, I'm about ready to pull out my dead-looking boxwoods. What would you suggest that would be healthier and equally ornamental? John, I'm going to throw that to you. You've got 20 seconds to solve this problem.
There's a really cool, lightly used evergreen called a dwarf elkhorn cedar, and I think that's a good replacement suggestion for a boxwood.
Dwarf elkhorn cedar.
Correct.
That sounds fancy. Okay. Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Professor of Biological Sciences Teresa Cully, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you. It was fun.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Cecilia Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.